This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. What happens when the U.S. criminal justice system wrongly convicts and incarcerates you for a crime you did not commit? If you are lucky enough to be exonerated and released years later, what happens then? Those are some of the questions that my guest, Allison Flowers, attempts to answer in her new book, Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity, in which she follows the lives of four exonerees, Christine Bunch, Jacques Rivera, James Kloppelberg, and Antoine Day. Allison Flowers is an award-winning investigative journalist focusing on social and criminal justice. She's written for The Guardian, Village Voice, and Vice News. She's a Social Justice Nexus Fellow and works at the Invisible Institute, which is a journalism production company on the south side of Chicago, where she was part of a team that won a Hillman Foundation Award. She now joins me to discuss her new book, Exoneree Diaries. Welcome to the program, Allison.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What was a hard book to read? The stories are very sad. You know, this is one of those kinds of things that when they happen, you think, what a waste. What an awful, awful waste of a human life. First, tell us why you chose to focus on exonerees and why these four people, three men and a woman, how did you pick them?
So I decided to start looking into post-exoneration issues because I used to work at an innocence project, a journalism-based project that investigated potentially wrongful murder convictions. And so that's how I was spending my time investigating these old cases. It really occurred to me one day as I was heading into my basement office at Northwestern University that, you know, we're doing all this work to try and uncover evidence to potentially free the innocent, which is very important work to do. But I started to wonder what happens when those innocent people are freed. What resources do they have? What's left in their lives? Who do they turn to? Where do they live? And I realized this was several years ago, about 4 years ago, that there really wasn't an infrastructure in place or any resources to support this community of people leaving prison. And so I wanted to start looking into their cases. I was connected to three male exonerees, had a radio program on Chicago Public Radio for about a year. After that series wrapped, I really wanted to add a woman to the fray when it came time to write the book. The reason I chose the four cases I did is that they represent the different flaws in the criminal justice system. So first of all, the men and the woman in the book, they're racially diverse. And so I didn't want to ignore the race component of the wrongful conviction problem. But also there are a lot of other contributing factors when it comes to wrongful conviction, such as official misconduct, eyewitness misidentification, perjury, bad forensic science, things like that. And through these four people that I profile, by getting to know their cases very well, you begin to see the different flaws in the criminal justice system. And then as far as adding a woman to the exonerees that I profile in the book, I felt it was really important to do so because women really face a unique set of challenges as exonerees and also as in their wrongful conviction. 43% of women are wrongly convicted of killing or harming a loved one under their care, and oftentimes it's their own child, as we see with the woman in my book. And so they face a lot of sexism along the way. They're told not to cry. They're told that if they cry, then it's manipulative, but then if they don't cry, then they're perceived as cold-hearted killers. And so there's a lot of sexism that pervades the system when it comes to women's cases. So I wanted to show that as well.
Repeat that statistic. That sounds astounding. 43%? What was the rest of it?
43% of women's cases where they've been exonerated, if you go back and look at their cases, they were wrongly convicted of killing or harming a loved one under their care.
Wow.
And so this targets a lot of caregivers, women often being the primary caregiver in their families, and daycare workers and babysitters and women like that. Hmm. So Christine Bunch in my book was wrongly convicted of killing her three-year-old son, Tony, who died in a trailer fire, which was an accidental fire, but the investigators suspected Christine of arson. And some very bad arson science was used in her case, as well as some official misconduct, which changed the results of the fire samples in her trailer from negative results to positive results. And so she was dealing not only with outdated science in her case, which contributes to a lot of wrongful convictions, but she was also dealing with official misconduct.
So here's a woman who's lost her three-year-old child, the pain of which is unimaginable. You never recover from losing a child. Then she's accused of killing her child. Then she is incarcerated for 17 years before she is let free. And you also, by the way, point out in your book that a few months into her case, she finds out she's pregnant, so she has a child while in custody. So she, you know, has a teenager by the time she's set free, who she's hardly had a chance to get to know. One tragedy compounding another. How does one recover from such a thing?
Exactly. And, you know, the judge in her case, when she was pregnant at trial, actually accused her of becoming pregnant so that she could garner sympathy in her sentencing.
Wow.
So that's just another example of kind of the sexism that exists in the criminal justice system that women face. But you're right, Christine was not able to parent and mother her son from prison the way, you know, that she would want to. She had more contact visits than most, but it was still very difficult to do. So she came out to a very angry and confused teenager who was now almost a man. And a compound tragedy, of course, is that she lost one son in the fire. She had the other son in prison and didn't get the chance to raise him. So she came out to the outside, and a huge part of her story in the book is the quest for fertility and to be a parent. And that's a tragedy of women in particular who are wrongly convicted, is that depending on when that wrongful conviction hits their lives and how long they're behind bars, they may lose out on the opportunity to have children.
Or to have to raise children. Had it not been for lawyers relentlessly fighting to free women like Christine, Christine would likely have remained behind bars. I mean, just like the cruelty of the system, you point out in your book that between her knowing that she was going to get a new trial and actually being freed, she just waited weeks because a trial judge went on vacation.
Yes.
I don't know why, but that little fact just really angered me.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of exonerees, I would say most, really don't know that it's happening, that they're going to be released. When a wrongful conviction, wrongly convicted person is released, you know, the conviction is either overturned or it's vacated or the charges are dropped somehow. So a lot of times they don't have much more heads up than a day or even a few hours, as we see in Antoine Day's case in the book as well. Christine had some heads up, but then she was left waiting because it had to go back to a lower court where a judge needed to hear it. And as I mentioned in the book, he had some vacation plans that stood between her and her freedom.
Jacques Rivera is the second exoneree whom you profile. Another tragic story, convicted on the word of a single eyewitness to a shooting, and that's it. And he too spent well over a decade in prison for something he didn't do. And it was only after the witness recanted their testimony that he was freed. How much of his life did he lose? And also paint a picture of the framework within which his situation happened. This was sort of police looking at gang activity with a broad brush, right?
Right. So Jacques Rivera is a former gang member. He was, leaving the gang life, trying to create a better life for himself and his family when he was wrongly convicted. A 12-year-old boy witnessed the shooting of a family friend. He happened to be standing near a building in a drive-up shooting that occurred. And when police asked him to look at photographs, he was looking through books of photographs and he saw Jacques Rivera's picture and he said that the gunman looked like him. Well, police took that pretty far, and Jacques Rivera was known to police at the time. And so when it came time to view a lineup, the eyewitness was very much pressured into identifying him. But what was not disclosed at the time of trial was that there was actually another lineup in which he was not identified by that boy. It was only on the second lineup that the boy felt like he had to pick Jacques Rivera because he was being pressured to do so. It was actually sometime after his identification that he had seen that real gunman in the park and wanted and tried to alert police to his mistake after he realized it wasn't Jacques, but that sort of fell on deaf ears. So by the time of trial, he was coached to a point where he could just point to Jacques in the courtroom and say, yep, he's the one who did it. And this is something that really haunted this boy as he became a man over the 21 years of Jacques Rivera's incarceration. I mean, this really changed both of their lives. And, you know, it was a very short trial. This was really the only piece of evidence against Jacques Rivera. But investigators for the Innocence Project found the boy who had grown up, become a man, started his own family, and left any sort of gang ties with his family behind, moved to another state, and that's where the investigators found him. When they approached him, he immediately knew what it was for, and he said he's been waiting, you know, 20 years to come clean with the truth. And so that's really the evidence that ended up freeing Jacques Rivera from prison, you know, the recantation of a single eyewitness. And eyewitness misidentification is very common. We see it in about a quarter of cases. So it definitely happens, and your eyeballs are not as reliable as you think they are.
Now, Jacques lost a lot of time with his family, with his children while he was incarcerated, but I understand that he did get some financial compensation. I don't know how any amount of money could ever compensate for losing those years of one's lives, but tell us about that aspect of it and if that has helped him start a new life, and also if it's even typical for exonerees to get compensated.
So compensation is not guaranteed to exonerees, and all exonerees leave prison without any immediate resources. So they don't even have a bus pass or necessarily even their own clothes on their back. And I've actually heard of some exonerees being charged for their prison shoes or whatever they're wearing that belongs to the prison. Oh, they get a bill in the mail later, which is really insult to injury to the extreme. So all exonerees leave without any immediate resources, no housing, no bus pass, nothing. Okay. Their records are not automatically expunged either. So in order to seek compensation, you have to have been convicted in a state that has a policy or a law to compensate exonerees. There are only 30 states and DC that have such policies. And even for those states, many of them fall short. The policies aren't very good. Here in Illinois, the most you can get for a wrongful conviction is $200,000, no matter how long you were behind bars.
So one year or 25 years, it's just $200,000.
That's right, which isn't even $10,000 a year. And that's, you know, not even saying anything as far as the disadvantages of not being able to save for retirement or save period. So to be releasing people after a long incarceration when they're later in age, and now you're only compensating them if they happen to live in a state that has compensation up to a certain amount. So the laws are actually very, very, very sorely lacking. It takes a while to get the compensation even once you are approved to get it, which is a separate legal process. So you actually have to go before a judge again and prove your innocence to the court, which is very difficult to do, as you can imagine, after evidence has been destroyed in your case or witnesses may have died. It's not the same as proving that you weren't guilty at the original trial, and it's not enough that your conviction has been vacated or overturned. You have to prove your innocence again in order to even get that compensation in many states. There's still 20 states that don't offer anything. And then, of course, there's always civil lawsuits. You could sue the city, the police department, but those cases are pretty rare when they're successful. So the headlines you see about exonerees winning millions of dollars because of some sort of abuse, those are very rare. It's hard to prove the level of misconduct required in order to win a lot of money in those cases. So that is not an option for most exonerees. Hmm.
Well, the next exoneree we'll discuss was in fact tortured during his incarceration, but I want to actually play for our audience the trailer for your book that has videos of the four people that you profile in your book, Exoneree Diaries, One Woman, Four Men, just so that we can kind of hear from them directly. These are real people with real lives and real backgrounds and, you know, just serious personal tragedies in their incarceration. Here are the four exonerees.
It's everything right now. more than I can put into words.
Jacques Rivera finally gets to hug his three now grown-up children as a free man. And another big hug for his mother, who's always known her son never killed anyone.
Being an exoneree is definitely, after all the lights and the cameras are shut down, life begins. It kicks in a very neutral position because you don't know which way to go, what to do, or how to get it done.
I was sentenced to 60 years for arson and murder and the death of my three-year-old son. And I spent 17 years in prison for a crime I didn't commit. You're scarred, you're marked forever by what you've experienced. And stepping back out just because now I'm free hasn't made everything right. It hasn't made everything good. Things aren't falling into place.
They opened the door, they gave me the $14 and change I had on my prison account and said, be no more. You don't belong to us, gone, go.
My troubles just began. I mean, I appreciate, you know, my freedom. I appreciate justice, but my troubles are just beginning.
And that last voice you just heard was Jacques Rivera, and you also heard the voices of Antoine Day, James Kloppelberg, and Christine Bunch, four people that are profiled by my guest, Allison Flowers, in her new book, Exoneree Diaries, A Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. So it was amazing to actually, you know, put faces and voices to the people that you talk about. Let's discuss James Kloppelberg, another horrific story. These are all just very sad stories. What happened to him? And not just in terms of what landed him in prison, but also the torture that he experienced while he was there.
So James Kloppelberg was a handyman on the south side of Chicago with a family when he was wrongly convicted. He was accused of setting fire to an apartment building that killed a family of six. So he was actually serving six life sentences when he was released almost 25 years later. In his case, what led to his wrongful conviction was, again, perjury or a false testimony, false accusation from someone who wanted a break on his own case and also had an axe to grind against James. And so that person said he witnessed James going into the building and saying that he started the fire. The fire was actually ruled an accidental fire. And so it wasn't another, you know, four, almost 5 years later that this so-called witness came forward with what he saw. And he did get a break on his own case and is now incarcerated elsewhere on very serious charges. But what happened to James was what really set in motion his wrongful conviction was a false confession. He was tortured and beat into a confession by police officers serving under a very notorious former police commander named John Burge, who is responsible for the torture of more than 100 African-American men and some Hispanic men in Chicago. And it has only been in recent years that the city has recognized and apologized for the torture that occurred under John Burge and has agreed to provide reparations to the victims. James is actually white, but he was tortured by some of Burge's underlings. And Burge actually said, after James confessed, falsely, of course, he said to the press, gave a statement to the press about the confession. So, you know, this was very much a Burge case in that scenario. I write about this commander in my book. It's sort of a thread throughout. You see Burge-like characters in other police officers in the book. But, you know, he's still collecting a police pension, and he ended up only serving a few years in federal prison, not for the torture that he oversaw and some of which he did at his own hands, but actually for perjury, for lying about the torture because of the statute of limitations issue. And so that false confession that James gave was actually tossed out by a judge. So the jury in his case, never heard that evidence, but it very much set in motion his wrongful conviction. And honestly, for a judge in Cook County to not be able to look the other way and to throw out these the false confession is a big deal, which means that it was so clear and so evident that James had been beaten into that confession that they couldn't accept it as evidence in court. But it really still set in motion, you know, the grand jury proceedings and everything else, so that by the time they got to trial and they had this so-called eyewitness saying that, you know, James committed this crime, it was hard to overcome that.
Another, then your fourth exoneree, also convicted on eyewitness testimony, is Antoine Day, the African-American exoneree among the four that you profile. 1992 was his conviction. 2002 was when he was exonerated. So a 20-year, basically, loss of the time that he spent, a loss of the life that he could have had. This was also, I understand, a Chicago story. Tell us about what happened to Antoine.
So Antoine was convicted of an attempted murder and murder on the west side of Chicago. And again, it was a false accusation that led to his wrongful conviction. It was no more than rumors in the neighborhood that he was somehow involved in this crime when he wasn't even at the scene of the crime. And so, you know, there were a lot of practices that were poorly handled at the police department. You know, one person who says he had witnessed the shooting had actually talked to Antoine in the waiting area of the police department before picking him out of a lineup, which is absolutely a no-no when it comes to lineup procedures and properly identifying a suspect. And so Antoine was basically convicted on perjury, another false accusation, and that's the leading cause of contributing factor, that is, to wrongful convictions. It takes not a lot of evidence, just someone's word against yours to wrongly convict you. And so Antoine was taken away from his family and spent 10 years in prison for these crimes that he didn't commit. And while he was in prison, his son was murdered and he was not allowed to attend his son's funeral. And not only that, but he was put in the same jail cell for a time when he was awaiting a new trial at Cook County Jail. He was placed in the same jail cell as the man who was accused of killing his son.
Wow. And
so to Antoine, that was very much a safety risk. And he felt very much set up, you know, as if people were hoping he would react poorly to that and perhaps do something violent, you know, in retribution. Antoine had the presence of mind to actually refuse housing, which meant that when you do that, when you refuse housing with a particular inmate, that means that you have to go into solitary confinement, which is not a great place either.
So he chose solitary confinement rather than be jailed with a person who killed his son.
Correct.
I'm speaking with Allison Flowers, and we're talking about her book, Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. There's so much more to talk about with Allison, so we're going to keep her on for an extended interview that you can find in the premium content on demand section of our website. Allison, in terms of Antoine and really the other exonerees as well, what was the fight for him to gain his freedom like? What was that fight about? And is there a common thread where basically you aren't just released by the system? You have to present evidence. The most you can ever really get is a new trial?
It really depends. So. I would say that above all, if you have any hopes of leaving prison, you have to have a strong advocate on the outside who's willing to stick with your case. And all of these exonerees ultimately found that support after sending hundreds of letters to organizations for help. So it really requires someone hearing their cry for help to ultimately lead to their freedom. In Antoine's case, it's a little unique because he had a real estate lawyer who had never done criminal appeals decide to step in on his case. They had a family connection or a family friend connection And so all of a sudden, this Columbo looking, you know, real estate attorney shows up at the prison and wants to talk to Antoine. And he says, I'm going to help you. Of course, he asked, did you do it? And Antoine said no, and he believed him. So this real estate lawyer helped get him out. But even he didn't know that the conviction was going to be vacated. And so what basically happened was the prosecutor at one point decided, you know, look, we don't have enough evidence to hold him anymore. All our evidence has fallen apart. And so that's one way that an exoneree will be released, when the prosecution decides to drop charges. Another way is through a post-conviction petition, which exists in many states, where they'll basically appeal and a judge will choose to overturn a conviction and maybe order a new trial as well. Oftentimes, while that inmate is awaiting the new trial, prosecutors will then decide to drop the charges. So it can happen in a variety of ways.
Right.
Not always is there a new trial involved.
I see. Now, in the case of Antoine, one of the things that made me smile in all of these stories was that he's in a band. I'm guessing that it's not sort of typical for exonerees to be able to find happiness right away and find ways to rebuild their lives right away. Is Antoine one of the lucky ones who has managed to, I mean, I found photos of him smiling as he played the drums in the exoneree band, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he definitely fostered a love of music as a child and, you know, was a budding musician when he was wrongly convicted and his life was taken away from him. While he was in prison, he started out very angry, of course, and it took him a while to decide to start fighting for himself rather than against himself. And he kind of cleaned up his act a bit in prison because he was getting into it a lot with the guards and other inmates. But once he decided to do that, you know, he created a band. He asked the warden for some old drum sets and that kind of thing. He created, you know, something out of the rubble of his horrible existence in prison. When he got out, that was one of his first joys, was connecting with his old music teacher next door and getting to kind of jam again with him. He plays in so many bands, I can't keep track of them all. Exoneree Band is one of the ones that he likes to play with. And they do things like, you know, Battle of the Band fundraisers here in the Chicago area for different causes. He plays every year at the Innocence Network Conference, where all the innocence projects that try to free the innocent come together. And so, you know, that's been something that he's been involved with for a long time. It definitely helps him feel more free. That and motorcycles are his two passions. Hmm.
Finally, overall, after having written this book, Allison, it's unimaginable that one can just pick up one's life and make something good easily out of it after having gone through decades of incarceration for something you didn't do. Aren't lives just irreparably damaged by going through these things?
You know, there's really no making up for lost time. The word exoneree actually means to be freed of a burden. And that is a definition that does not really ring true for the exonerees that I have interviewed and gotten to know from my book. They feel very much burdened by their experience. They never forget the horrible things that have happened to them, and it really does haunt them moving forward. You know, however, I would say that exonerees, because they've had so much time to examine what went wrong in their lives and the injustices committed against them, they've had so much time to think about that question that they've come to the realization, maybe sooner than the rest of us here in the free world, that bitterness is really something that holds you back, and hope is the only thing that can move you forward in your life. And so, you know, it's one foot in front of the other. They really have committed themselves to just moving forward and trying to make the best of the years that they have left. Of course, it's no like Pollyanna type situation. They still get angry at what happened to them. But ultimately, they're just wanting to move forward with their lives. But, you know, there's no making up for lost time. There's no being made whole. It's a gap in their lives that, you know, can never be filled.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Allison, and for writing this book. It's a remarkable book, and I really appreciate all the work you put into it.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest is Allison Flowers. She is a Social Justice Nexus Fellow and works at the Invisible Institute, a journalism production company on the south side of Chicago, where she was part of a team that won a Hillman Foundation Award. She's written for The Guardian newspaper, Vice, and others. And we've been talking about her book, Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.